Joshua Huffin reported in the Trussville Tribune in Alabama on March 26th of this year, the city of Birmingham's signature monument will be lit in white each evening in a show of solidarity with the community as the fight to control and halt the spread of the coronavirus pandemic continues. The Vulcan statue overlooking Birmingham will be lit each night in white as a message of hope. This will continue for the foreseeable future. The reasoning, according to Vulcan Park and Museum President and CEO Darlene Negrotto, is that the Vulcan statue is a symbol of promise and a reminder that the community will prevail through these trying times as a collective whole. Vulcan stands as a constant reminder of who we were, who we are, and who we will be, Negrotto said. The stories of members in our community helping each other in the wake of this adversity can serve as an inspiration for us all. It is our hope that the lighting of the Vulcan will inspire others to join us in the spirit of community. It is useful to have a monument that you can adapt to various circumstances, and that seems to be the story of Vulcan. It's interesting to realize the history of the statue of this mythological figure, Vulcan, god of fire, metalworking, and the forge. The work has been known as the largest cast iron sculpture in the world and the second tallest statue in America, commissioned for the 1904 Louisiana Purchase Centennial Exposition in St. Louis. The casting of the 56-foot tall, 60-ton Vulcan was a technical feat of the iron founder's art, and it was viewed by 19 million people at the St. Louis Exposition. The artist who created the design was Italian sculptor Giuseppe Moretti, and he prepared an 8-foot clay model for his assistants to make full-sized patterns and molds. The methods they used for that and to scale up the model to the full-sized pattern were traditional ones. The making of the molds and the process of casting were complex operations because of the size. School students were brought in for tours because of the marvel of the size and the enormity of the project. Vulcan's feet and thighs left Birmingham bound for St. Louis on April 18, 1904, and the rest followed shortly thereafter. There was a lot of controversy about the original design of the piece when Moretti's 8-foot clay model was displayed at the city's commercial club. Some of the committee criticized the rough appearance of Vulcan, expressing instead a preference for a handsome Hermes. But Moretti's interpretation won out. As depicted in his model, Moretti's figure of Vulcan appears normally proportioned, with no sign of lameness or physical deformity, as Hephaestus, his Greek counterpart, showed. That so characteristic of the idealization in the creation of civic monuments. It's interesting to note that the statue of Vulcan, and pardon the pun, did not really catch fire. For more than a year after the St. Louis Exposition, Vulcan lay disassembled next to a railroad track before being incorrectly reassembled at the state fairgrounds and used mostly as a prop for advertisers. All that from the article Vulcan, Birmingham's Industrial Colossus by Matthew Kierstead about the checkered history of a civic monument. Think of the enormity of that project and the symbolism of the image, what it meant then and as it's promoted now, how it almost never rose again after the splash in St. Louis. Think now of a band of young people, some the age of those who toured Vulcan in the construction phase, using, in essence, the very same techniques to create monuments they've designed, worked in clay, ready to be made into molds. And though not grand in scale, grand in meaning, grand in the meaning each one holds for the apprentice artists taking part in the 2020 workshop hosted by Keystone Ironworks, marking 11 years of sessions for students in northeastern Pennsylvania. Artist Nikki Moser is co-founder of Keystone Ironworks, and we had a chance to speak with her by phone about the project.
Keystone Ironworks, this is actually our 11th year. And really, we started with an idea to work with at-risk high school kids, thinking that mentoring them in a fairly dangerous activity, casting molten metal, but with artists and with members of the community and with college, other college student mentors, to really think about this as a civics lesson. We like to say Keystone Ironworks, casting the future with an eye on the past. And of course, because Scranton has a historic furnace and there were so many industrial partners and museums and things, we really had a great group of energetic people working with us, and we had a really wonderful studio to work in. So the students really got this amazing, rich experience of making an individual thing and then starting to work together in teams in the studio, working with the artists in the studio, and then working as a gigantic team at the Arts on Fire Festival. And our students have never paid for classes, so their give back to the community would be to cast iron tiles for the community. And so there was this idea of reciprocity, of civic duty, of engagement that we underpinned all of our programming with.
The notion that we started with, Nikki, was the idea that you can't do iron work alone, and that's what you're suggesting when you're talking about bringing these students together. Tell us a little bit about the dangers, literal dangers, and why you can't work alone.
Well, the furnace at an industrial level is kind of a horrifying monster. At the level that we do it, we run a small furnace, but safety is paramount. But when you're working in the studio, you can start out by yourself. It's a group of students who don't know each other, and you can start your pattern on your own. But then at the next stage, you have to build a wooden flask, and you need somebody to help you hold that. So you've got to make friends with the person next to you or talk to them at least. And at every interval, as the next tool gets introduced and the next activity gets introduced, the students have to build a bigger and bigger team. So there's trust involved. And all of that groundwork of beginning to work as a team and really seeing the artist mentors who have cast metal together really work as a team in the studio creates a safety net, like an emotional safety net and a physical safety net. So at any point, what we say to the students is we only want you to do what you're comfortable doing. You can be nervous. You can talk to us about being nervous, but you never want to be in a situation that you don't feel safe or comfortable doing the activity. So little by little, we build teams. And then when you get next to the furnace, that furnace is producing iron that is 2,800 degrees and molten, and it's a monster. It will bite you. So by then, the students have had a chance to walk through the safety protocols. They know how to put on their safety equipment. They've worked together in teams, practicing how to use the ladle to pour in some molds. And again, there's always someone, a mentor, right next to them. But this idea of relying on people and also being a team, and for a lot of our students, that's a pretty foreign concept. They don't always have that support. And to be able to grow a team out of a disparate group of high school students from high schools all over the area, it's pretty impactful. And our students, you know, our students from 10 years ago talk to each other all the time. They're a little family, and it's exciting.
You also, in the midst of all of this, were part of welcoming international iron artists to the region for the international conference.
That's true. In 2018, we had this extraordinary opportunity to host the International Contemporary Cast Iron Conference, and we had close to 500 people come in from out of town. We had over 1,000 attendees locally. We ran 21 simultaneous art exhibitions of cast iron artwork. We had 5 days of casting iron. We took train rides. We did live performances. It was just extraordinary. And our students were a part of that. And to have the international community to come in and to be able to, you know, highlight Scranton and its industrial past, it's like still in the community, that's one of the best conferences ever held. So we're really proud of that. And it was really fun. It was exhausting, but it was really fun to do.
Nikki, then you had some activity this past summer. What was that project? And how did you have to adapt for the circumstances?
Well, it was really a dilemma. You know, as everything shut down, we had been planning our spring activities, and we didn't know what to do. And I sort of looked around, and our partners, Kay Dard and some other people, we talked and we said, you know, maybe we just stand down. Like, everybody's home. This is a lot for everyone to sort of wrap their head around. Maybe we don't need to be adding another layer. And then, you know, quite honestly, after the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and other things that were happening, we really felt like it was time to take Keystone Ironworks in a direction that we didn't always have time to take it. So we had always had some kind of content, often historical or related to the area, but students had to do so much work in the studio that we weren't actually delivering a lecture every week. And we sat down, we put our heads together and reached out to Black Scranton and to Travis Prince. And we said, you know, I've always wanted to do a class called Monument, Marker, and Memorial, and really discuss the origins of those things and how those things are placed in an area, who decides how they're placed, who decides what the content on a marker is, and really dig into the situation that was happening in the United States and with monuments being torn down and monuments being, you know, reworked. And then we reached out to Carrie Furness, and they had an iron pour, a socially distanced iron pour, on their calendar for September. And we were like, okay, that's going to work. We won't be able to bring the kids, but we can get their pieces cast. So what we did is we did it on Zoom like everybody else was doing it. And twice a week we met with the students, and Travis and I would do a lecture, a slide presentation of primarily artists of color and kind of contextualize their work in these different areas of Monument, Marker, and Memorial. We also talked about local things. I'm sure that you know where it is, but there's a really interesting marker for Queen Esther in Wyoming, with two very different signs attached to it. And so we discussed the local ramifications of these things from, you know, indigenous to contemporary. And then we sent the students clay and pattern boards. And this was really a challenge. I didn't know if this part was going to work. And our students just dove in. They're as anxious and scared about what's happening in the world right now as we were. And this really gave them an opportunity to talk about it and to respond to it. And I've never shipped clay patterns back and forth like this. We did great. They arrived in the mail safely. And then Maddie Jason, who's, again, one of our teaching partners, she and I loaded everything up. Well, we made the molds at Marywood University. And then we loaded everything up in a truck and took it out to Carrie Furness.
And they were ready to grant you the access that you needed.
Yeah, Carrie Furness is a much larger version of what happened here in Scranton, really, you know, where iron went after it left this region in so many ways. And they're in Pittsburgh, and they were super careful, really extraordinary team out there, Paige Henry, and they donated the iron and they donated their time helping us cast them. And then we brought them back and shipped them to the students. And it was a really interesting, it was exhilarating as a teaching artist to have so much extra time to dig into the content. And I think our students really responded to that. So we were just awarded another grant from the Overlook Foundation. And we're going to kind of springboard off of that success and I think continue along those lines. There's so much we could teach out of this area for a long time. So we are going to be offering another set of classes for high school students starting in January. We're going to be accepting applications. Again, the workshops are free, as they always are, and we'll be teaching via Zoom, because we know that's coming, given how things are going. And we'll be teaching in February and March, and then we're going to be partnering with Shepherd University in West Virginia. And Shepherd University is where our teaching partner, Kay Dart, is, and she runs their Fab Lab. So we are going to be taking advantage of using the Fab Lab and the digital facilities somehow. We're not quite sure. We don't have that worked out yet.
Are there openings for people who are hearing our conversation, or are you targeting certain schools? How are you going to form the student base?
We are going to be accepting high school students from the Shepherd University area and from the Scranton area. So anyone who's hearing this on your radio waves can contact us. Keystone Ironworks has a Facebook page. You can send us a message there. You can join the group. We also can be reached via email, and it's keystoneironworks@gmail.com. And you can look at our website. We have a website, keystoneironworks.org. And if you're interested in the programming, or you have a student, or you know someone who is, drop us a line. We'll start a list, and as soon as we're ready to go, we'll be in touch with you.
Artist Nikki Moser, co-founder of Keystone Ironworks, speaking about the 11th year and the Summer 2020 workshop, a partnership with Black Scranton Project, investigating and responding to current events, digging critically into the history of monuments, markers, and memorials. For more information about taking part in the next workshop, keystoneironworks.org, KeystoneIronworks.org, or you can look for their Facebook page, and that's a session that will get underway in the beginning of 2021, and it will be Zoom-based. That's Keystone Ironworks, and you can find out more information at KeystoneIronworks.org.